There's one. Set for stun.
Don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
Inconceivable!
And welcome to the second book of the month for The Unique Geek. I'm your host, John, and with me on the phone, we have a full slate of people that are anxious to talk about this month's book of the month, which is Watchmen. And it's written by Alan Moore, and as Shag always points out, Dave Gibbons is responsible for the art. So let's get started. First of all, let's go around and introduce everybody. From the typical Unique Geek cast, we have Michael Bailey.
Hey.
We have Sterling.
Howdy.
Todd.
I'm back.
Yes, Patrick.
Hey there.
Thanks.
Shag.
The irredeemable Shag.
Yeah, all right, we get it. Carrie.
Good evening.
And also joining us tonight, a special, we have girls. Maria is joining us. Hello, Maria. How are you?
Hello.
And possibly the woman I envy the most, because she must have the patience of St. Paul or whoever, Holly. Holly, Todd's person that has to put up with him on a daily basis. How you doing, Holly?
Great, Sean.
Hey, Holly. Holly.
You ran her off.
Good job. Well, we have one woman now. Okay.
Hey. Yes.
We'll go with that.
That's some kind of record. Like 2 minutes into the podcast, we're already scaring away the girls.
Yeah, it's like high school all over again.
Todd's back on the line. Let's try and pull him back in again.
Okay.
All right, we're going to move on. Anyway, let's just briefly discuss what the book we're discussing. And as a forewarning, if you haven't read Watchmen, probably don't want to listen to this unless you just don't care to read Watchmen, because we're going to spoil everything. And again, the book's been around since 1986. Am I correct?
Yes.
So if you haven't read it
by now you're a lazy ass.
Yeah, well, I just finished it about 2 seconds before we started recording. I had finished it, so there you go for the first time.
You skipped all the text pages, didn't you?
No, I didn't. That's what took me so long. I wasn't expecting that.
The text pages, yes. Yeah. Well, they're brilliant.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, they are probably one of the better parts of the series, especially in book form.
Let's briefly run this down. Watchmen, according to Wikipedia, is a 12-issue comic book limited series written by Alan Moore and illustrated, in quotes, by Dave Gibbons. originally published by DC, it was a monthly limited series from 1986 to 1987, and then later, I guess more famously, became a trade paperback, and from that point on, it's the only graphic novel to win a Hugo Award, and it also appeared on Time Magazine's 2005 list of the 100 best English language novels from 1923 to present. It is the only graphic novel to appear on that list. So, needless to say, this has a lot of history. And might I say that I enjoyed watching the television version of Watchmen when I saw Heroes. Anyway,
if only.
But I'm bummed.
Let's first of all go over, let's go around the horn and get everyone's initial impressions of Watchmen. You know, what you, just briefly, what you liked about it, what you didn't like about it. Let's start with Maria.
Well, before Watchmen, I didn't really have that much contact with comic books as opposed to, I think, everybody else on this call. And I'm the odd geek out, I guess. But Carrie introduced me to it, and he said, you've got to read it. I'm an English major, so I read quite a bit. And I was actually surprised with how much I enjoyed this graphic novel. It was fabulous. It's literature. I don't even think of it mostly as a comic book, which when I tell people I read this great comic book, they go, oh, but you like books and stuff. So I guess it's just
Let me ask you, when did you read it first? I mean, was this this your first exposure to it, or had you read it before?
Oh no, this was the first time.
Oh, awesome.
I just quickly glanced through it right before we got on the phone, actually. But I read it for the first time about a year ago.
Okay, awesome.
I'm new to it. But I must say, the part of the graphic novel that I just absolutely hate is the whole pirate thing. I hate it so much.
Sacrilege.
Oh no! Oh no! Trust me, I can't be alone. I refuse to be alone on this.
You are not alone.
Oh, good.
Well, then, Shag, since you're piping up, why don't you go ahead and give us your initial impressions?
Well, I first read it back in 1990. In fact, my copy, I mentioned this on another podcast, says actually happy graduation from Race, who's on our listserv as well. Got this in 1990, read it, and just devoured it. And I've read it several times since, and absolutely loved it. Now, the pirate thing, really, I know there's the whole parallels and the symbolism, but it really dragged for me. And didn't care for that part, so you're not alone there, Maria. But overall, it's a great story, especially back in its time. It really gave you an insight to the way that superheroes could be regular people, too. I mean, some people had done a little bit of that in comics, but this pushed that so far forward. And I'm glad I read it back then and can see the downstream effects nowadays.
How about you, Patrick? Your initial impressions?
I first read it. I picked up the trade paperback in April of '88. And at that time, I was just coming off of that Frank Miller high with The Dark Knight Returns. So I was in the comic book shop, and I had some money to burn, and I said, hey, what's this giant tome? And I flipped through it and saw the wonderful Dave Gibbons art, and I said, well, this is certainly worth the money. So I was not disappointed. And, you know, I read it every year, usually, so I've got 20 readings of it at least. And I love the comic. I mean, I love the graphic novel, and it's just, I discover something new each time. I think I mentioned that before on the listserv, but every time I read it, there's just something that I see brand new. It's amazing.
Awesome. Let's cut over to Sterling. Sterling, what's your
Watchmen
thoughts?
Is good.
All right, and moving on.
You should read this book. This is a good
anyway.
But why is Sterling on the podcast?
He's learned. He knows things.
Tells me his copy is sticky.
Oh,
you know,
that is
actually,
so wrong and inappropriate.
If I may say, one thing that interests me, because this was born out of going with Watchmen as our second book of the month, was born out of another thing was it Sterling that was looking for recommendations for a summer reading list for some kids? And and one thing that you said, though, that there was a lot of you said there was a lot of sex in it, and I hadn't read it before, so I was expecting a lot more than what was actually in there. It certainly was not anything that I had actually originally thought it would be.
I saw boobies.
What was
but,
that?
I mean, it's not explicit, but it is there. I mean, the whole rape thing and
yeah, it's just though that I think from that perspective, it's people, kids, teenagers especially, are exposed to that a lot, much more graphically on regular television than it was anywhere in this novel.
I think it had a lot to do with subtext of sexuality in the story itself, where Rorschach's mom was a prostitute, and she regularly beat him. You had two homosexuals in the book itself, and they were superheroes. And they were just, every once in a while, you see pictures of naked people and things like that. Especially Dr. Manhattan was walking around fully naked after a time. You know, and his dangling was all over the place. So, but you're right.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that there was a great deal of sexuality in it, but it is not. It wasn't glamorized like most pop culture.
That's correct.
Sexuality.
That's correct.
Well, Carrie,
I think it's the content of it.
Why don't you go ahead and give me your initial impressions, sir, Carrie?
I came to it a little bit later than most. I only read it about 2 years ago, I believe. I had run across Alan Moore's other stuff long before then, V for Vendetta, Top Ten, some of his other books, and I enjoyed them, and found Watchmen via that, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. Partially because of the way he portrays a lot of his books, and that the characters just happen to be superheroes. It's actually a story more about the interrelation of characters that I can really buy into.
Okay. Holly, what about your learned impressions, initial impressions?
I think, I can't remember exactly the first time I read it, but it was probably about 10 years ago. And, of course, you know, thought it was just wonderful. And then I ended up teaching it in a contemporary literature class in 2001. I don't think the kids quite got it, but I thought it was an interesting thing to do.
What age level was that that you're teaching that for?
Kindergarten.
I don't understand why they didn't get it. It had pretty colors.
It's an upper level college class.
Oh, okay.
But not upper level. It's like a 2000 level, so sophomores. But it's pretty much everyone from freshmen to seniors took it.
Michael, what about you?
I first read it back in around 1996. A buddy of mine lent it to me. And I love everything about that book except the pirate comics. So, yeah, not alone on that. And I really think the ending kind of falls apart. I think it's a problem I have with Alan Moore in general, is that he tends to create these sweeping epics, and I really get involved in the characters. And it's probably my own damn fault, but when I get to the end, it's like, wait, that was it? You left me with this? So... But more than anything, I really enjoy the history that he created for the characters, going back to the Minutemen. I liked the relationships between Night Owl and Silk Spectre. I liked the concept of Dr. Manhattan. And more than anything with Dr. Manhattan, I liked his explanation of how he sees all of time at once, really. And they kind of tried to explain that in the Who's Who entry for Watchmen, and which I had read like a bunch of years before actually reading the book. But it wasn't until I read the book that I actually understood what they were talking about. So I love the book. I think it's incredible.
And that's a nice segue from the previous book we just covered.
Oh, where yes, this is true. This is very true. Where we had Slaughterhouse-5. If you haven't listened to it, go ahead and head on back and listen to it. Where we had a dude slipping in and out of time, and so everywhere he went, he kind of just understood what was. He was reliving his life over and over again. Todd. If anybody cares, Todd, what's your opinion?
Well, I like the book. I actually liked the pirate thing. I thought it worked well with the story. It kind of, I liked how not just with the pirate thing, but with other themes. He kind of shadowed the main story with these little side stories, you know, how you continually saw the comedian falling, like in the first couple pages and everything. It would switch back between real time and the past, and they did that a lot in the book. I thought it really worked well, and I think the pirate thing really helped with that. So I loved it. I hated the ending, though. I was pissed.
Really? Well, ask. Well, Sterling, why don't you give us a quick rundown of the plot and include all the spoilers and everything if you can. Just quickly give a synopsis and even the ending if you don't mind.
Okay.
I know, I'm putting you on the spot there.
Yeah, really. Okay, the comedian was a superhero. He was thrown out of a window. Rorschach saw this as a conspiracy to get rid of all the superheroes. And he started investigating. No one would believe him. And then he basically, through the sequence of investigating, we learn about all the different characters that are involved in that superhero group and in that superhero community. Finally, he hooks up with his old friend, the Night Owl. And they learn who is involved in killing the superheroes. And they realize what the main purpose is. The main purpose is the villain actually wants to create peace on Earth. But in order to do that, he has to kill millions upon millions of people.
Sorry.
In New York City, and when he does that, everyone else is like, wow, I guess we can't stop you, because he already did it like 35 minutes before he told them what's going to happen. And then Rorschach was the only one who said no, this is wrong and I'm not going to accept it. And he didn't accept it. And Dr. Manhattan killed him. And that was the end of the story. Was that too fast?
Well, that was a very good. If anyone takes Holly's class again, I think they'll be able to pass it. No problem. Right, Holly? Yeah.
Not really, but
of course,
that's the gist of it. I guess that's the premise for the new the movie.
It must be because, yes. As everyone knows, there is a movie that's being made, and this
coming
is
out.
By Zack Snyder, the same guy that directed 300.
Yeah, it's
you know what I heard? I heard that Dr. Manhattan's going to be a cloud.
Hey, I do have a comment about the ending. I loved that the big bad guy tells him the whole freaking plan. They're like, oh, we're going to stop you. He's like, what, do you think I'm a fucking moron? I did this like half an hour ago.
Yeah, that was the great thing about it.
There we go again.
Yeah. Really good.
That's why he's the smartest man on Earth.
But at the same time, the reason why it falls apart for me is that if he's the smartest man on Earth, he should realize that whatever unification he was going for by killing all those people was going to fall apart within 5 to 10 years. And this is a man that is constantly seeing into the future and planning ahead. So why would he even bother when he knew it would just all fall apart anyways?
Where did he say it was going to fall apart?
Now, I'm just talking general human nature. Is anytime you bring a bunch of people together by one disaster, within 3 to 5 years, it falls apart and they start squabbling amongst each other themselves.
Sure, when you're talking about a natural disaster like an earthquake or a hurricane.
Well, what about
9/11? You're talking about a huge, giant alien that landed inside New York City and basically psychically screwed with people all over the planet. I think that's going to last for a little bit longer than 5 years or 10 years.
I mean, we could get into the parallels and talk about.
Go ahead, Gary.
I was going to say, expanding on what he said, you're talking about an event that could potentially change the foundation of several different societies around the world. Imagine the impact on religion. Suddenly, you've got this gigantic extraterrestrial creature that can do horrific things. It kind of undercuts the concept of, like in the Christian church, the earth is the center of the world, man was created in the image of God. And so it could have a profound and very long-lasting impact on the entire world.
Let me ask you, wouldn't the presence of Dr. Manhattan also kind of bring that to a head anyway?
One would think so. However, I can see how it might not have quite as much because at a casual observation, he's still a man. He's a man that can do incredible things, but he's a guy. He was a guy, now he's a guy with superpowers.
This is true. Does anybody who wants to break down the characters, and then I kind of want to go around and ask everybody what their favorite character in the book was.
This is Shag. I'd be happy to break down the characters if you don't mind.
No problem.
Okay. I'm also going to talk about how some of the parallels of where they originally came from. They basically all fall into fairly easy templates of superhero characters. I mean, you've got your Dr. Manhattan, who is your superhero. I mean, he's the one with the power. He's the one who can affect everything. He's almost godlike. Are you looking for more personality type, John? Or
that's fine. Whatever.
Okay. Rorschach is your kind of Batman-esque, over-the-edge, crazed, vigilante. He's the one who's going to go to the ultimate extreme. So he really goes beyond Batman in that, I guess. He's more he's going to hunt him down and beat him and kill him if necessary to get the truth. As Carrie points out here in the chat, Batman plus Wolverine. Then you have Night Owl, who is a more traditional Batman-esque, 1960s or really Blue Beetle.
One or two. Because there's two of them, so the
first true. Good
Night
point.
Owl.
Both of them actually. They're back in the day. Night Owl was pretty similar to the original in that he was kind of the upbeat, sort of guy. But the second one really had all the gadgets. He had all the cool gimmicks and everything. And the comedian is your sort of Punisher, over the edge, with a gun, killing, doing government work, not really caring. I guess I'll talk about the parallels of where they really came from, and maybe that'll be a little easier too. when Watchmen was developed, they originally envisioned using these Charlton characters that DC had purchased. And after thinking about it long and hard, they kind of said, well, Alan, you know, we just spent a lot of money to get these characters, and you want to kill them all. So that's really not going to go over too well with us. So they changed all the characters. But the gist is Dr. Manhattan is a extrapolation of Captain Atom. If you guys read DC Comics at all, you've probably seen a little bit of him. Rorschach is an extrapolation of The Question, who's also in DC Comics, has appeared in the Justice League cartoon. Night Owl, both the first one and the second one are extrapolations of Blue Beetle, who was an original Blue Beetle-type character who was very much the original Night Owl, and the second one was very much like the second Night Owl. Lots of gadgets. You know, even the Night Owl, even the Blue Beetle has a flying bug, whereas Night Owl has a flying owl. Comedian was supposed to be Peacemaker, who was a violent government operative.
Actually, no.
Okay.
He was actually more based on MLJ's S.H.I.E.L.D. character, because Alan Moore has said in several interviews that he also wanted to use the MLJ heroes from the 40s, and that's where the Comedian came from.
Interesting.
If I'm remembering it correctly.
It's not what I had read, but that certainly could be true. I kind of thought the Comedian name was a parallel to Peacemaker as well, because you got Comedian, and obviously he wasn't funny. Peacemaker certainly wasn't a peacemaker either. Anyway, so you get a picture there. Ozymandias is based on Peter Cannon Thunderbolt, who has appeared a few times in DC stuff. He had his own series for a little while, but didn't really stay around too long. But he's supposed to be the most brilliant man in the world, and he's trained his mind and his body to perfection. And then the last major character is Silk Spectre, and she is based on another character from Charlton called the Nightshade, sort of a Black Canary-esque character. Female crime fighter, street level, kind of, you know, fisticuffs sort of girl.
Right, let me go around the corner and Todd's distracting me. Anyway, anybody, let's go around and again and just talk about the characters. And who was your favorite character? Yes, that's what I said. Hey, Maria, let's start with you. Save me, please.
Well, I think I have two favorite characters. And one, I think, just because he's so interesting, Rorschach. It's fascinating. His entire story, the chapter that they did on him, and his exposition, his mother, like, already been mentioned, being a prostitute, and him being ashamed, and that bleeds over into the future with his landlady that despises so much because she's a prostitute. And I love the fact that he was trying to become this other person and really believed that he was, and wearing the big shoes and the mask, and it was just very interesting to read. But I think, out of sentimentality, my other favorite is Night Owl, because I have such a crush on him. The second one. Because he's so sweet. And him and the whole Silk Spectre thing, they were so sweet together. I just can't help it. I'm a girl.
Really? You like the second Night Owl? Okay. Well, I guess I really didn't cover the first Night Owl, so I mean, you couldn't really like him, but that much. Interesting. So you really kind of got into the whole romance aspect of it as well.
I did. I don't know if that's just because it was not what I was expecting. It just came out of nowhere. And I was expecting guys, macho stuff, and then all of a sudden there's this little love story embedded in there. And at the end, they're the only ones to live happily ever after.
That's an interesting...
Sure, they have to assume other identities and change their hair colors and go off into the sunset, but they did. The rest of them are screwed or dead. But Night Owl and the Silk Spectre make it. And that gave me hope. I don't know.
Let me ask you, because talking about the ending there, it was like that ending for me came out of nowhere. All of a sudden, she was, well, let me go ahead and have sex with you. You know, whatever.
Rebound.
What's that?
Rebound.
Well, when Silk Spectre had sex with a Night Owl? Is that what you're talking about?
At the end, yes.
She's on the rebound, man. Come on.
Once you go blue, you can't go back.
She'd been with the same guy since she was 16 years old.
No.
She finds herself with some other guy. She totally rebounded on him.
My point is, at the end, basically the entire world has changed, and they're just now consuming this information, and I guess that really turned her on? Is that what the whole deal was there?
No, it was a confirmation of life. We need to let each other know things are okay. This stuff is so beyond us. We need to get back down to basics. And based on Dr. Manhattan's smile at the end as he was walking across the water, a la, Jose, he knew what was going on. He approved of it. He thought it was great. And that's kind of like why he pushed them together in the first place. Or maybe he pushed them together in the first place.
Huh.
That's my thinking of it.
All right. Well, I guess. Maria, do you agree with that?
Sure,
I'll take that. Whatever. I just thought it was cool.
I'm just kidding. Rebound?
Kidding.
No, if you remember in the story, they tried to get together at first when they're listening to the news going on and then talking about Dr. Manhattan and such, and it was very awkward and it didn't work out very well, but when they did their fighting crime, saving people from a burning building thing, that's when the heat, pun intended, started to accumulate. That's when things really started, because
it was the speed effect.
Yeah, even Night Owl said there's just something about putting on the costume again. It just made me feel so alive, and oh, I just want you right now. So, I don't know. It really tied in the story for me. It made it important why they did it to begin with, why they dressed up silly and did what they thought was right, and it awakened something in them.
It was kind of like he had been emasculated by the Keen Act. And he wasn't actually himself. He wasn't the man that he wanted to be, even because he couldn't go and do those things. And when she supported him in that, and when he finally took that step and said, no, I'm going to do it, whereas before, when they tried to have sex, it didn't work out. But after that act, after they said, this is who we are, this is what we do, it kind of made him complete again. And so he was more comfortable with himself, and therefore he was more comfortable with her.
Definitely.
Wow.
Well, Sterling,
that's really deep, Sterling. Seriously, that's interesting too.
But this whole book is full of stuff like that. That's why this is so good.
I'm not knocking it. I think he's onto something.
Then Sterling, who's your favorite character?
Rorschach.
Really?
Yeah, I could have predicted
that.
I got to chime in. And knowing Sterling in real life and role playing with him, Sterling is borderline Rorschach, y'all.
I'm just saying,
keep 600 feet at all times.
I think that of all the characters, his was presented in the most black and white way. His was presented in a way that said, this is right, this is wrong, and yet his whole history was filled with shades of gray and complexities. And I just really enjoyed this guy running through this world the way he did.
Sterling, do you have a set of clothes in a back alley somewhere?
I didn't say I'm idolizing the guy. I said the guy was a lot more interesting than a lot of the other characters.
What about you, Todd? Who was your favorite?
Oh, Rorschach, yeah. I mean, right. I'm just giving Sterling a hard time. I like Dr. Manhattan also, but he pissed me off a lot, so... I went with Rorschach.
Why did he piss you off?
Just because it was like, hey, we get it. You can see the whole fucking end of time or whatever, okay? Get over yourself. You know, it was like, you just do something. It just kept bugging me how it kept going back to, you're going to say this, and then you're going to say that, and then I'm going to jack off. You know, I mean, it was just like, it just got repetitive.
Well, and that was the most striking bit of dialogue, too.
Well, Holly, seeing as you have to live with this man who apparently has a potty mouth, well, who was your favorite character?
Okay, well, you guys already took my answer. It was going to be Rorschach. Psychologically speaking, he is the most compelling. And in fact, the whole chapter with the psychologist, I thought that was the most compelling chapter in the book for me. Just how intensely he was able to affect this normal, happy guy in just a matter of days. And just kind of destroy his whole life by changing his whole perspective on the world. It just, was really impressive.
Who when you taught the class, who did any of the kids they're in college.
They're kids. I call them kids.
Was there anybody that were they all pretty much in agreement that Rorschach was the coolest or was the coolest man? He was elite. Or
I don't know. I mean, they were. Yeah. I don't. Again, I don't know if they really. I don't really. Know if they got it. I don't know. And it was my first time teaching it. You know, I was teaching a lot of other really heavy stuff in that class, so I think they hated me. But you know, so I'm not sure actually who they liked or not.
Did you pass any of the kids, or did they all fail?
Oh no. They didn't. They didn't fail. I mean, but I remember. I'm sure, they did fine. I don't know.
All right.
I did have some kids write their papers on it, actually.
Really?
In fact, I think one of them did a small graphic novel of their own.
And turned that in as a paper? Really?
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome. Patrick, your take, what's your favorite character and why? Well, let me ask you, let me trip it up a little bit too, Patrick.
Go ahead.
Who's your least favorite character also?
Remember that guy that was standing on the corner right outside the Gunga Diner? Yeah, I hated him.
Yeah.
He pissed me off.
And that was on page 12, right?
Yeah. Well, and 42 and 68. Yeah. No, I
the pirate book?
Or yeah. Paper? No, he was awesome.
You totally stole my guy. I was going to say the kid reading the comic.
Not fair. No, I'm with everybody else. Rorschach is easily the most compelling character, just because of the whole black and white, you know, motif. Obviously, with the mask and everything, and seeing the world with no mixture of gray at all. But just going back through the last few days, you know, I'm really struck by chapter 4, which is Watchmaker 1, which is, you know, Todd's favorite, with him just explaining time being, you know, contemporaneous to him, and he sees everything. Dr. Manhattan sees everything as equal in the eyes of time. But what I find mostly compelling about the whole story is you can actually take all of these pages and stick them in the DSM Diagnostic Psychoanalysis Manual, because every one of these characters has some kind of dissociative, psychopathic, pathological, schizophrenic, whatever, disorder, and just to be able to see them in each of their plot developments exhibit all of those psychological problems is absolutely incredible. I mean, it's just the whole side of comics that we never see. And, you know, Alan Moore, I think we're actually seeing into his soul, because he's such a, you know, nice, normal writer. And, you know, we're seeing windows into his soul with the way he developed each one of these characters.
I mean, even if you look in the back cover, at least on the edition I have, of The Watchmen, Alan, he's a freak. he looks like Ted Kaczynski.
That was his Christmas photo.
He looks like Ted Kaczynski. It's
yeah. They really did an interview in Wizard where they took a bunch of pictures of him, and most of the picture was filled with his beard. So
he is quite a furry man.
If you ever read Twisted Toy Fair Theater, you've got to find the episodes where Alan Moore shows up. They're hilarious.
Michael, your impression.
My favorite character is actually Night Owl.
Oh.
And I will say both of them to a certain extent, because I like the whole Guardian origin they gave to the original one. But to me, the second one is such a compelling character, because he's this man that is... There's a shot right in one of his first appearances where he's in his workshop talking to Rorschach, or however you pronounce it. And after Rorschach leaves, he's sitting there, and the way Gibbons drew it, he drew it with him sitting there with a shadow from where his costume was being cast upon him. And I looked at that and I said, this man is living in the shadow of his past, and he cannot get past, he can't get through that. And it's his relationship with the Silk Spectre and getting back into being a hero where he really seems to find his balance. So I think that I love Rorschach. I really like the comedian, but to me it was Night Owl that really stole the show.
All right, what about, let's see, who hasn't had a... Oh, Todd. Yeah, Todd.
No, Todd already said he liked
Bullshit. Oh, yeah, that's right. I just completely forgot because he's...
Shag
is boring. How about you, Carrie?
Sorry, what?
How about you, Carrie?
Oh, yeah. Surprisingly enough, I think my favorite character was probably Ozymandias.
Hmm. Now, why? Defend yourself.
Well, first off, my first impression, he was a better Dr. Doom than Dr. Doom.
Okay.
To be maniacal, a super genius, almost undefeatable, without having to refer to himself in the third person. He was compelling. He had the same sort of dissociative behavior that Rorschach had, but in a slightly more compelling way. He genuinely believes what he was doing was right and proper, and is willing to do anything whatsoever to further these gains, because it is the right thing to do. In his mind, he's the hero. And I really like that sort of psychological conundrum that his character presents. Now, Rorschach is a close second behind that.
So interesting. You both of them, well, all of them ostensibly are trying to do what's right, but Rorschach, on one hand, goes to the extreme of... Well, I guess both of them go to the extreme. They're actually kind of similar,
but there's
aren't
a difference
they?
Between Rorschach and the big smart guy. Rorschach's doing stuff because he thinks it's right. The big smart guy's doing stuff because he thinks it's right, but he's also doing it for ego. I think he's doing it on a global. Reactive. He's doing it on a global level, and
he does spend the majority of the graphic novel talking about his action figures. So. Mm-hmm. And his marketing, and his, oh god, what's it called? The Lynx. Bubastis?
The cat that he had.
Yeah. The genetically engineered cat, who I really enjoy. She's cool.
And so I think that's the difference between, even though they still have, you know, the motivations are still doing what they think is right, the reasons behind those are different. And I think they're different on scale. Not just on individual details.
Well, I think that the way they go about it is predicated by their backgrounds. Rorschach is reactive. He was a victim of mm-hmm. the surroundings, a prostitute mother, no father, small guy, got beat up, victimized in his workforce. He reacts to his surroundings.
Right.
He began the entire investigation because of the comedian being killed, because of what he perceived to be wrong. If these things had never happened, he probably would have stayed underground.
Yeah, and
Ozymandias, proactive. He foresees something's going to happen. I'm the smartest man in the world. I can make it better.
And even Rorschach going dark, as he did after the kidnapping of the little girl, was a reaction to... the events surrounding, you know, the criminals got darker, so he did too.
Yeah, sort of. Good point.
Hmm. What about you, Shag? Shag, you're the only one not to chime in on your favorite.
I think that Rorschach and the comedian are actually the most interesting characters in the book as far as their personalities, their motivations, and everything. But I gotta say, the character I connected the most with was also Night Owl. A lot for the same reasons Michael Bailey said, probably a lot more eloquently than I could. But also just, he seemed like the common man. He seemed like, you know, Jimmy Stewart was just waiting to play the role. He's the guy who is the guy, he's the guy next door. You know, he's the guy that you can relate to. He's the guy who lives in your neighborhood. And he's torn between all this. He's trying to figure out what he should do next. And that's what appealed to me. By the way, quick thing on the comedian. I was reading this book, which I'll talk about later, but turns out the comedian, his visually is based on Groucho Marx, believe it or not, like a really tough Groucho Marx.
You know, I can see it once you mention it.
It's an interview with Dave Gibbons, so it's not theory, it's actual. That's who he based him on.
Interesting.
Wow, that's kind of interesting.
That puts a funny twist on it, actually.
Funny, huh?
Funny, yeah.
let me ask you, Maria. Shag just pointed out that, you know, he could see Jimmy Stewart playing Night Owl. Who would you see?
The person who you're trying to reach is currently not available. Please leave a
Patrick
message
Wilson.
After the beep.
I'm sorry. You were going to say? Who would you see playing
Patrick Wilson is actually the guy that they were talking about. He was the one that played the the angsty father and little children. And he's been in tons of things, really, but nobody really recognizes him aside from little children now. But I think he'd be a good choice. He's a sensitive kind of actor. Hmm. And I think he could do quite well. But the one I'm really excited about, if they get him, is Jude Law as Ozymandias. I think he'd be fantastic.
Yeah, John Cusack.
That's actually really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, John Cusack was wanting to get in on it too, and I think he'd make an excellent Night Owl. In all honesty, I'm serious.
Who?
John Cusack.
Really?
Yeah, there was an interview on Comic Book Resources about it.
Ah, interesting.
He was.
I agree with you. I think he would make a good Night Owl.
And there was a time 10 years ago that Kevin Spacey could have really, you know, given him some flaming orange hair. He could have really pulled off the same kind of psychotic Seven character as, you know, as Walter Kovacs or Rorschach, or, you know, it totally believable.
He's retired now, though.
Yeah.
He's sitting up in the old Vic in London. He's too happy to start.
Until the next
again.
Superman movie comes around.
You know, for Night Owl, I was kind of picturing someone a little more, you know, dweeby, like the, I don't know his name, I apologize, but the guy who played Dr. Phlox on Star Trek Enterprise. You know, kind of a slightly
really?
Overweight.
No.
You know, that kind of hair.
He's too, his build is completely wrong.
Not for Night Owl. Night Owl had a little bit of a paunch.
Wait.
He did.
The dude that played the holographic Doctor?
No, no, no. This is not Voyager.
Sorry.
This is Star Trek Enterprise.
I
don't remember his name. I apologize. Someone said it a moment ago.
Phlox.
All right.
I'd have to argue with that too, because he is a little dweeby, I guess you could say. I guess that's the best way to say it, is that he's just so damn thin.
I'm on IMDb and I looked up Patrick Wilson, and I think you're right on that one. That he'd be a pretty good one for that one.
He's
probably
good.
Need to, yeah.
But he is kind of fit, though. I mean, they'd have to put him in a fat suit or get him to eat.
Right. He'd have to gain at least 20 pounds or something.
The person who you're trying to reach is
Todd's not answering his phone. He got dropped off. Go ahead.
I'd also like to make a quick apology to Shag. I had misread something. And yeah, he's right. It was the Peacemaker for Comedian. So
that's okay. I'm just going to take it out of your ass, Dragon Con, this year.
Oh, there's nice. No trivia contest.
No, I meant a physical beating. So I'm going Rorschach style. Man. I'm going Rorschach on you, man.
But you're gonna put a cleaver in my skull?
Maybe.
Okay.
Where to next, John?
Oh yeah, okay. So, what I would like to discuss real quick is some of the parallels that you saw between what was in the book and what's happening in modern day and what's happening in comics. Why don't we start with you, Michael Bailey? Anything that strikes you as you know, particularly groundbreaking in this that has carried over?
Well, this and Dark Knight were like the two watershed moments for comic books in 1986. So what it did was to kind of shine a light on how silly the concept of people, or the silly the concept can be, of people running around in tights and fighting crime, and, you know, in like a realistic sense. The story that Silk Spectre told Night Owl at the very beginning of fighting that one guy who just wanted to get a beating from everybody because that's how he got off. I mean, you never really think of Captain Cold or the Riddler doing that, but it kind of made it more realistic. Unfortunately, Alan Moore was trying to say something and everybody listened wrong, so we got 20 years of grim and gritty and deconstruction and decompression, and I think as much good as it did, it also led to a lot of bad things as well.
Can I just make a quick comment on that? Not
sure.
To go in a different direction. There's a fantastic book. If you've been to Borders, you've seen it and you probably ignored it, but it's called The Dark Age. Grim, great, and gimmicky postmodern comics. It's by Mark Voger.
Yeah, I have that book.
A Spawn on the cover, and pretty much the book is a huge book about comic books in the 90s and how dark and gritty they were, and it attributes almost all of it to The Dark Knight Returns and Watchmen. Not in a bad way, just as that they were the genesis.
No, that guy was kind of a jackass at times. So,
well, I liked the book. I thought it was pretty good. So
I thought it was a good book too. He was a jackass.
It's called The Dark Age. I think it's worth checking out.
Yeah, I think you get that through Tomorrow's Publishing.
Holly, have you seen any, or can you think of any influence with this book on other literature since then, or anything else that you've come across that speaks to this particular book? Still there?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. I don't know exactly how much influence it's had, except for maybe like on a few people. I don't know. It's the whole thing of graphic novels and things that are comics, you know, not being considered literature or not widely, you know, being accepted. I mean, it took until 2005 for it to be on a Time list. I mean, it took 20 years. So I think maybe in 20 years from now, we'll see some, you know, some development. But right now, I don't know how much, except for in the comic book world, that it's had an effect on, I guess, what normal people call literature.
I don't think any of us would consider us normal. So therefore, we're living inside this box. The Shag, what about you? You just brought up in the chat there about the parallel of 9/11 and the alien massacre of New York. It's actually a very insightful foretelling, I guess, of what actually happened after 9/11. You care to elaborate on that?
Well, honestly, what got me thinking about it was just a few minutes ago on this call when we were discussing how the alien, you know, attack in New York, the theory was to unite the world. How long would that united front actually last? And, well, 9/11 is somewhat of a parallel. I mean, 3,000-plus people died in New York. And for a short while, it did unite the world, and it united the United States in quite a bit. Some of that's still around. There's still, the impact is certainly still felt, and there's still some that united feeling, I think. And I don't really know where to take it from there, other than there's definitely the parallels. It's definitely interesting the cause and effect of, you know, what happened and what Ozymandias was planning. And I think someone who's a lot smarter than me would probably write a lot of thesis and papers on that. I did want to comment on one other thing that Holly had talked about as far as the graphic novel format and everything. I was listening to a podcast from DC Comics not too long ago. They did mention that Watchmen has actually sold more copies in the last 4 years than had previously entirely. So I guess like 15 years worth of sales compared to the most recent 4 years. And the last 4 years have sold more copies than the previous 15. Pretty impressive.
And just jumping off of that from what Shag added, it's hard to avoid the realization that we are, as a society, very, very cynical. We're news-driven, and we always believe that there's an underlying sinister cause. And, you know, all you hear for the last 5 years is that there was some kind of malevolent conspiracy going on behind the 9/11 attacks. And I think some of that plays back into where we are now, 20 years removed from, you know, the innocent age of the 80s when Alan Moore put this out, that we're always looking for some deeper meaning or a factor behind what, you know, could have been a random, you know, just act of terrorism. But you know, people, I've heard everything from, well, you know, the our own government, the hijacking, you know, and did all this and that, and you just hear this whole wide range of very cynical and in some ways actually very, very crazy theories behind this, just because we're looking for a conspiracy. And this goes back to our need for a conspiracy behind, you know, JFK and whatnot. But it shows how far we've come just in 20 years.
Well, it's kind of funny that you say the innocent age of the 80s, because when this came out in the 80s, it was talking about the innocent age of the 60s. So was it really that innocent when it came out? It was talking about a more innocent time even before that.
It's very true.
I mean, there's a continuing theme about, oddly, it's odd, maybe not odd, but sad, that there's a continuing theme of a problem in Afghanistan, because of course back then it was the Russians invading in Afghanistan. Of course, now the United States is there, for right or for wrong. It's weird that somehow you know, more things change, the more they stay the same type thing. It's and sad in a way that somehow, and I guess that speaks to what the character Dr. Manhattan was trying to talk about, was that, you know, no matter what you're doing, you're just going to wind up, it always turns out the same. You're not changing anything. The only reason to change, or the only reason to help or to interfere, is because there is this miracle that's life or what have you, and that at some point each one of them is precious, even though they're predestined to do whatever it is that they're going to do. From his perspective, it's still random how everything happens, but in the global sense, it seems like nothing has ever changed. Sterling, you had something you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, well, based on what you just said, but that's, I wanted to also say that that's where Rorschach was coming from, is that when he went and he found the person who kidnapped that little girl, the six-year-old girl, and found what that person did to that six-year-old girl, that's when he became the Rorschach character. And part of the philosophy of the Rorschach character is life is what you make it. And if you're going to make it evil, then life is going to be evil. And his intent was to get rid of evil so that life was better. And I think that's where he was coming from.
Yeah, and since he was based off of the question and Ditko with the question and then with another character named Mr. A, it was kind of like there are no, everything's black and white. You know, he keeps talking about how, I think it was President Truman was a good man. Mm-hmm. Was that it?
Yeah.
Trying to remember. Right, yes, he worshipped Truman, yes, because yeah. Truman dropped the bomb on the Japan and saved and stopped the war, but he had to kill hundreds of thousands of people to do it. And ironically, Rorschach was against the plan of letting the alien go because it would kill millions of people. So there's a contradiction there in Rorschach's thinking at that point. And I don't know where I think his thinking is black and white to a certain level.
Is that so much because he didn't see those deaths as necessary as the Japanese in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? I mean, because he didn't agree with Ozymandias' plan, didn't think it was going to work. To him, maybe those deaths were meaningless. Because
right. I think he's reacting, as someone previously said, he's reacting to things that happen. Meaning, if we were in a war currently, he would have approved of dropping an alien in the thing to get world peace. But since we're not yet there, since we have not yet crossed that threshold of Armageddon, he was going to do whatever needed to be done past the line of actually, you know, killing innocent people.
He was absent a father figure, so he treated, you know, President Truman as the ultimate, you know, government authoritarian father figure. And, you know, he had no problem with that, with Truman's decision to drop the atomic bomb. But at the same time, he looks at Ozymandias and, you know, who's this guy? He's just some punk that he assumes is, you know, borderline homosexual and just soft and pampered. And who is he to make a decision to use this, you know, conspiracy to kill millions of people? So I think he sees it again in black and white, that government authority is correct in all ways. And when one man takes it upon himself who's not in an authoritarian position, then that's wrong.
Todd, you...
But that's in a simplistic manner. The only thing he can see is the evil being perpetrated, not the potential good to come from it. Again, he's strictly reacting. He perceives thousands of people are going to be killed. I have to stop this. Someone mentioned that he idolized Roosevelt. Yes, Roosevelt dropped the atomic bomb, but it was in reaction to a perceived wrong done. It was not a preemptive attack.
Right.
Okay. Todd, you actually wanted to add something?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just noticed, like, throughout the book that Rorschach kept commenting how everyone's crazy but me, and so-and-so is nuts, and et cetera, et cetera, but to me, one of the reasons I liked Rorschach was he was the craziest guy in the book. You can't look at him and say he wasn't just insane.
I don't know. I think the comedian has a few happy, crazy pills in him as well. So
I don't think the comedian's crazy at all.
He just doesn't care. Yeah.
I don't think the comedian's crazy. I think the comedian's totally got his head on. Well, I don't agree with him, but I think he's got his head on straight. I think he just has a very different sense of morality.
It's sociopathic versus psychopathic.
There's a really funny moment in the Denny O'Neill question series where the question is reading Watchmen and throws the book down and says that Rorschach's crazy. So, but for him, in his mind, he's perfectly sane. So it's like, who is the crazy one then? I mean, obviously it's him because he's a psychopath. But I think it's worth mentioning that to him, he's just fine. He probably would have. I don't think the comedian's crazy. I just think he was reacting to the being in World War II, really.
He's in Vietnam, yeah.
No.
He went to World War II as well.
Yeah, he went to World War II. That's where he first started up. If you read the text pieces.
Oh, that's right. They have a picture of him in 42 or something.
So I think the comedian wasn't so much crazy. He was just one of these people that saw too much. And this is his reaction. He just laughs at it.
And him shooting his Vietnamese mistress?
Yeah,
who was pregnant?
To us, that's crazy. going with everything that man has seen in his life, it's just like, I don't need this. She's gone. I mean, yes, to us, he's crazy, but I don't think to himself
I wouldn't say he's crazy. I'd say he's amoral.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a better way to put it.
Different sense of morality.
There's an image that I really liked about the comedian. When they talk about the clown that goes to the psychiatrist or something like that, and the doctor says, oh, well, there's this comedian, the great Panini or something in town. You should go see him. It'll make you feel better. Pugliacci, whatever. And he's like, well, I am Pugliacci. That just really kind of defined his character.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Well, some people want to talk about the artwork, not me necessarily. I'm actually not that big of a fan of this particular, the art in this particular, because, you know, I like the more modern, computerized, clean lines type of guy.
Yeah, but I'm telling you right now, just about everyone who's tried to do dark and gritty, especially in the late 80s and early 90s, was chasing the page layouts and the symbolism that Dave Gibbons and Alan Moore through his script did in that book.
If you look at Michael's absolutely right. The page layout, the number of panels per page, and the way he's laid out some of these pages is so different from what was coming out in the 80s. I mean, this was the British Invasion, and this was the Beatles.
Brian Boland.
You're maybe overstating it a little, don't you think?
This is the Beatles. This is the Beatles for comic books. This is when it happened in the 1980s.
And Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons and Brian Boland and even a little bit later, Neil Gaiman came here. It was like the second coming of Christ.
Comic books took off. It's when, because of the Brits, comic books became a respectable medium. We wouldn't be sitting here talking about, you know, half the comics we talk about, Fables, whatever, hadn't been for them. And a lot of this, if you look at stuff from 2000 AD, which is a very famous British publication, a lot of this looks like it came right out of there, and partially it's because Dave Gibbons used to draw for it, but it just, a lot of it parallels there. And Michael talked a little about symbolism. That's something I want to touch on real quick. Like, I don't know if you guys noticed all the triangles throughout the story, whether it be the poster on the back of the wall where the husband killed the children, or the gay rights poster the lady wants him to, the newspaper man to hang up, or whatever. All of it is hidden throughout the book to show you that Ozymandias, because his company is, you know, the triangle, is really controlling the whole world. It took me a while to really see that, but it's here throughout the whole book. Go ahead.
And also, this was like, Watchmen was the end of word of thought balloons and panel descriptions, really, with comics too. Because after that, you didn't need them. Okay. No.
No one was arguing.
It's just an odd thing to say. I apologize. Move on.
Oh no apologies. You explain yourself now, Mister. No.
Did anyone else notice the? Go ahead, Pat. You first.
Well, it's what's great about Dave Gibbons' art is exactly what Shaq's saying. All the clues are there, and then on subsequent readings, you go back and you see every one of those clues that says, you know, hey, I'm Rorschach. You know, if you're just willing to look at the art in the background and things like that, there's just all these wonderful clues that tie in directly with some of the text, like the newspaper vendor saying. One particular one is as the guy's going through the trash, you know, the sign guy. You know, all you have to do is see the signs, you know, and you know, all the pointers are there if you're willing to see them.
I was wondering about a particular graphic thing that keeps showing up, and maybe I just maybe there's not more to it than it really is, but it is the splatter. Obviously, everyone knows the image of the smiley face button, comedian's button with the blood splatter on it. Well, that sort of imagery repeats a lot. When, again, going back to the house where the husband killed the kids. There's a like a sort of a Buddha poster with a triangle. But again, there's a blood splatter, and it's at that kind of, I don't know, 70-degree angle as well. There was another one. Oh, shoot. You know, I had it marked before, and I've lost it now. There was another very similar splatter. I think it was of mud, though, on another poster, and it shows up frequently.
The ketchup at the end of the book?
Mm-hmm.
The guy eating the sandwich?
Is there more to that? Then, just to remind you, anyone
maybe
know?
It's just an aspect of art. He's trying to show action by putting things at angles.
Splatters at angles?
Yeah, I mean when you're doing art and stuff, when you're drawing, you want to show action. You put things at odd angles, and you put things at angles to show things moving. And that's when you do when you're drawing.
Yeah.
If things are straight up and down, there's no action going on. You have to put things askew.
Have you been reading Scott McCloud again?
No, that's what you do when you draw.
Well, I guess where I was going is that there's a very distinct purpose behind this, that showing this angled splatter. But anyway,
it may just be something, you know, to keep a rhyming scheme almost.
Yeah, I think it must be what it is.
Something.
I mean, there has to be a constant reminder of it, because they keep bringing up comedian and they keep showing things that remind you of the blood on the button, because comedian never shows up in the story. It's just recollections of him. So this character is half there, half not, and then you have to keep bringing it back. It's a linear composition that way.
I think you're exactly right. That's got to be what it is. And I got a question art-wise. What the frig is up with the cigarettes? Like, some people have the cool, funky cigarettes with the bulb in the middle, you know, where you put the tobacco in the bulb, and other people are smoking just straight-up cigarettes. What's the deal?
The people with the bulbs are actually smoking weed.
Right on. Okay.
No, that's your class struggle right there. The upper classes get to smoke the nicer, you know, permanent cigarettes, and then you got the deadbeats living on the street smoking the old-fashioned tobacco.
I bet you're
Wasn't
right.
Wasn't there Lucky Strikes in one of the panels?
I don't know.
But was the pack green?
Go ahead, John.
Let me ask Holly this question. Which attracted you more to this novel? Was it the art, or was it the story?
Or it's hot ass.
Jeez.
Nice.
I guess I would have to say, I mean, the story, I mean, the art. You can't say one or the other, really. I mean, they work together. That's the way graphic novels are. It's like saying that I enjoyed the dialogue in a movie, but I didn't enjoy the, you know, but the movie features weren't as effective. I think, and you can say that, but I think this novel is a perfect example of how the art and the writing work together. In fact, they won an award for collaborating on the art and the writing in this. So I think it all works together, and you have to read the art just like you have to read the writing. I mean, that's, you know, what I told students is you have to scrutinize every panel and look for the symbolism. You look for the repetition of the splatters. Look for, you know, the triangles. And, you know, he gives you little clues, little foreshadowings as to the fact that Vitus, Ozymandias is responsible and not.
Since I'm not a writer or an artist, Do you think that they thought that through, or did it just kind of evolve out
it's
of...
It's definitely thought through.
Really?
Have you ever seen an Alan Moore script?
I don't think anybody's seen an Alan Moore script.
It's like the freaking phone book. The man spends pages describing a panel. Yeah, it was thought out.
I don't know if Neil Gaiman did the same thing with Sandman and his artist.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, you can love your mic, just don't love your mic.
Everyone should love Mike.
I would like to point out too that I'm reading the Wikipedia entry. Now I kind of give you guys some. I'm saying I didn't like the art. That's not entirely true. It's not to my taste. But actually, in reading the Wikipedia entry, they do point out some things about the artwork that kind of are very interesting. One that they used Dave Gibbons used a really cinematic approach to all the artwork, and as I was flipping back through it and realizing what actually happened is that, yeah, he blurred out a lot of stuff in the background that you didn't need to see, that you kind of to bring things to the forefront, as well as they point out that they rarely use motion lines to indicate motion. Now, I remember back in the day, back before Watchmen, motion lines were really, really popular. Everything had to, you know, had to have motions, these things are very still. All the scenes are very still. Even when they're fighting, it kind of seems like, you know, you're implying it almost in your mind what actually happened. Now, of course, it's true with most comic books, but usually they lead you along.
Reading Scott Cloud.
Usually they lead you along a path by showing motion lines or some sort of impact line.
It kind of strongly juxtaposes the Jack Kirby school of artwork, which up until that time had been pretty much the prevailing
right.
artwork type for comics.
Awesome. Anybody else want to point out anything about the artwork other than you guys liked it and I thought it was okay?
The David Gibbons artwork is the hook. Like I mentioned, when I picked it up and thumbed through it, it was the hook. But it was the storyline later that reeled me in and kept me coming back. But Dave Gibbons went on, you know, and worked with Frank Miller, doing the Give Me Liberty series, which is also quite good. Not quite as good as Watchmen, but they work very well as a team together.
Yeah,
and that's a phenomenal story too. So. That anytime I see Dave Gibbons' work, I will immediately pick it up.
I'd like to say I almost would have rather it had been a novel instead of a graphic novel. I think the story made it for me. I almost put it down because of the graphics. I don't like that old style of a huge paragraph with a little drawing in it. You know,
I have to completely disagree with that. I thought it was. The fact that Gibbons did have kind of an old school type of style that made it work because you believed that these characters were the goofy superheroes of 10, 15, 20 years ago. And the costume designs are just awesome.
Awesome as in like bad?
No, awesome as in like good.
Really? I think it was a combination of both. I mean, he could draw the goofy characters. He drew Dr. Manhattan when he was still human in that goofy almost 1950s Barry Allen kind of look, but then he'd draw the comedian, you know, mowing down a bunch of people with like Frank Miller lighting, you know, where he'd just be very 80s, very 1980s. So I think he mastered all the different kind of styles there. You know, he's mentioned Scott McCloud. We should look up Understanding Comics where Dave Gibbons falls on the chart, but
and also the you guys all hate it. Well, some of you hate it, but the entire pirate story is you know homage to the great EC comics, and the fact that Dave Gibbons can replicate that so seamlessly within that storyline is the wide range of his talent.
You know, that's a good point.
You know, I read something that they said that the reason why they went with the pirate comics was because the assumption there was that everybody inside of this world would think of superhero comics as being, you know, that's just a regular everyday type thing because they're so used to it. So they went ahead and then took it one step out. And the reason why they chose pirates as their theme to carry throughout was because that would be out of the ordinary for them there.
That's their fantasy. That's their escapism.
Yes. We need to wrap this up, but what I want to do is go around one more time, get your final thoughts, whether you would recommend this, but before we, I think it's pretty much a foregone conclusion what people would say. But any final thoughts on the book? I will point out this that Stan Lee calls this his all-time favorite comic book outside of Marvel.
Yeah, but what does he know?
I think someone gave him $5 to say that. So, and then he said,
"Oh man, Stan's taking a beating on the listserv, and that's not fair." He's a nice man.
Yes, it is.
It is.
It's a whore.
Well, most people,
you and me, outside after the podcast, man.
Most people do point out that it was, let's see, told with ruthless psychological realism, overlapping plot lines and gorgeous cinematic panels, rich with repeating motifs, a heart-pounding, heartbreaking read, and a watershed in the evolution of a young medium. However, there were some critics out there that actually asked the question of, did comic books really have to grow up? What really did this gain us, other than, you know, more violence? So, we'll go around the horn again one more time. Maria, your final and closing thoughts. Would you recommend this to somebody? And final thoughts.
Of course. I would recommend it to people who read comics, who don't read comics, to people who don't even read. I mean, just you have to pick something up that's so unique, that was an originator, something that actually makes you think about it after you put it down. It's not like those stories where you read it and go, okay, that was done. This is something that you could talk about for hours like we just did. I mean, it stays in your mind. These characters stay with you.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, as for thinking about it in novel form, there are just so many little things that you can't say in, you know, two paragraphs, that you can just show in one little panel, that makes it so interesting that you can just sit there and look at it and think, oh, I wonder what this means, and then go into in-depth conversation with somebody, as I do with Carrie all the time, about this graphic novel and talk about, what are they thinking? What were they doing there? It's really interesting. And that's what it comes down to. It makes you think.
Awesome. Carrie, your thoughts?
I would, again, recommend it wholeheartedly, not merely because it's simply a good story, as she stated. It's thought-provoking. It's intriguing. It's deep on and compelling on several different levels. It's also groundbreaking for its medium. It's one of the first that approaches a superhero genre as kind of an afterthought. It's compelling because these stories are compelling. The characters are compelling. They just happen to be superheroes. It could have been done with other types of characters or in other genres. It's simply a good story. It happened to be about superheroes in a comic book.
Cool. Shag?
And it led to so many new good things.
I'm sorry, Gary. Shag?
Couple different things. I'd say that definitely would recommend it. In fact, when I managed comic book store many years ago, I shoved it in as many people's hands as I could.
Except
possibly
mine.
I was going to say possibly even some of the people on the podcast. Another comment I think is worth saying is that this thing has aged incredibly well. This is, what, 20 years old now, right? And most comics from the mid-1980s are likable for the nostalgia factor. It's like, oh, I remember when Avengers were like that. Oh, that's so cute. But this is still powerful. I mean, it still has meaning and still speaks to you when you read it. And, I mean, we've got people on here that read it 2 years ago, and it's still an impact on them. And I think that people coming up watching, like, the Justice League cartoon where they get to know this character called The Question, you tell them, say, you know what? Here's The Question to the nth degree. And you give this to them as they get a little older, they're going to be like, wow, that is amazing. And one thing I have learned on this podcast by looking at the Wikipedia is that Mayfair Games, the role-playing game company, put out a couple Watchmen modules.
I have
one on my shelf, and I had no idea that Alan Moore okayed these. So I'm going to go back and look at these again. I just kind of dismissed them. Exciting for me. Sorry for you, suckers.
Patrick, your thoughts?
There are few joys greater than absolutely introducing this to somebody new and seeing their reaction after the first read, and then being able to discuss it with them on subsequent reads. But tying this back into the real world, I sent the link earlier, but if you go to Google Maps and go to the corner of West 4th and City. If you look on,
I'm
the
sorry,
corner,
you dropped out there. You have to say that again.
Oh, if you go to Google Maps and do West 40th Street and 7th Avenue in New York City, you'll find a nice little treat there on the corner where the Gunga Diner is. There is a grill that's very similar, and right above it looks to be a comic book store. So I think 20 years ago they were probably thinking, you know, some tie-in with somebody's relationship with New York. I think so. It's pretty cool.
Got to post that to the forum, Pat.
Sure, definitely.
Todd.
I really liked it. One of the big things I liked about it was the kind of out with the old superheroes, in with the new. Kind of made me really excited about the futures of the superheroes in the book. Like, for instance, you know, at the end when Rorschach and Night Owl are fighting Asmodeus, they just get their ass kicked. But then Dr. Manhattan comes in, and he's like, no, that's bad. And he's just goes off to become a god or something. That whole theme throughout the book of the old superheroes kind of giving up the torch really kind of made the book for me.
Cool. Holly, and let me throw you, I want to get your opinion. Let me throw you a question for the remaining people too. Would you expose the conspiracy at the end?
Expose it?
Well, I mean, you mean? Like Rorschach was going to. He was going to tell the world that the...
Oh, what would you actually do?
Yes. What would you do? That's what I'm asking you. And your final thoughts.
I'll have your final thoughts first. Yeah, about the book, I would definitely recommend it. Of course. Yeah, it fits what my definition of art is, which is that you can read it on multiple levels. You can read it on a very basic level and get a really, really cool story, but you can read it on many, many, many other levels and, you know, get a lot of subtext, a lot of symbolism, or you read it, you know, psychologically, you know, read it in so many different levels. And, you know, Maria said, if you reread it, you find something different every time. I don't think it was Maria. Someone said that anyway. But... yeah, in fact, I reread it again, you know, yesterday, and found some new stuff that I hadn't, you know, thought of before. So, yeah, final thoughts. Yeah, it's art. It really deserved to be on that time list. And would I reveal what happened? Probably not. Just like I don't think anybody really would in the real world. You know, it's one of those things like, well, it's already happened. It's too late. You can't go back in time and change it unless you're Dr. Manhattan, maybe. But, yeah, and we don't even know if it's going to get revealed at the end, you know, depending on what that, you know, kid decides to pull out of the crank file or not.
True. Sterling, your final thoughts?
Yes, I would definitely recommend this graphic novel and this book. And I know we didn't talk a lot about the pirate story, but the pirate story, I think, is an integral part of the book itself. A lot of the pirate story begins to, in the beginning, it doesn't so much as parallel what's going on in the real world, but as it goes on, as you're reading through the book, the things that are happening in the pirate story have parallels to what's going on in the real world, and they reverberate against each other. And that's what I like about this story, is there's duality of themes that are going on throughout the book. And what I think the pirate story is saying is, in the real world, you're dealing with these things and you think you're alone. But when you look at the pirate story, it's another person going through the same type of thing with the same similar themes, but he's not alone. And so, and in essence, nobody's really alone, because we're all dealing with the same things and we're all going through it together. And I like the duality of the pirate story throughout the main story itself. So I would definitely recommend this. John?
Yes. And Michael?
Well, I think anybody who is beyond just getting people who don't normally read comics or graphic novels, this would be a good one to put in their hands. But I think if you're really going to get into comics and reading them on a regular basis, this is one of the things you should have on your list to get to at some point. If nothing for outside of it being a really great story with compelling characters, it's important in the history of the medium. And you can kind of see it's one of the turning points where comics went into another direction. And would I reveal the conspiracy? No. I saw what happened to the last guy that tried that, and I'm not going for it.
All right, guys. For me, I must say, like I told you guys, I finished reading just before this podcast. This is a lot heavier book than I thought it would be. Very enjoyable read. Yes, I would highly recommend it. Would I reveal? Oh, certainly I would try to. Anyway. Thanks again, folks, for joining us for... Shag has one last comment. Go ahead, Shag. Always one to have the last word. Go ahead. Help yourself.
Nixon, 4 more years.
Really, you interrupted my wrap-up for that. Thanks, buddy.
Don't forget to mention our next book.
I was going to. Could you let me do the podcast now?
Oh, wait, we're doing a podcast
story.
We're doing a podcast?
Yes. Anyway, again, thank you for joining us. Join us next month when we do Neil Gaiman's... Gaiman or Gammon? Who's
Gaiman.
I'm going to ask Holly. Holly, your pronunciation.
It's officially pronounced Gay Man.
Okay.
Hey, man.
He actually said that at a gay lesbian, he got an award, and he said that he got applauded for just his name.
Hey. let me say that we also didn't even start to even briefly uncover some of the subtexts, some of the other stories that were inside of Watchmen subplots, including... interactions with gay and lesbian rights, things like that. So, anyway, again, join us next month for. Oh, sorry, someone's going to say something.
Can we have a separate pirate story podcast?
Tar. You and Sterling can enjoy that.
Yeah, I'll find something else to do.
The next book, anyway. Getting back to it, is Neil Gaiman's. American Gods? Is that what we decided on? Yes. Okay, yeah. So join us next month if you care to go through it with us. Again, check out
Robert Redford, 88, baby.
Check out the listserv. Google Groups. The Unique
Never going to have an actor president.
I'm just going to keep going. UniqueGeek.com. Check it out. All right, folks. Peace.
This has been a production of The Unique Geek. Visit us at theuniquegeek.com. You can reach the geeks by calling 813-579-3542. Send your comments, complaints, and story ideas via email to thegeeks@theuniquegeek.com. Join our list by going to groups.google.com/group/theuniquegeek. This podcast is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike license. Peace out.